Chapter 7. From Space to the Laboratory. The results from meteoritic studies can have a profound effect on science and society alike. But how did these samples end up in laboratories as objects of study? Would you be ready on a moment's notice to jump on a plane as soon as you heard news of a meteorite fall? Would the scientific and monetary benefit of having the freshest possible sample take you to places where you may end up being chased by corrupt authorities, imprisoned without so much as a phone call, or robbed at gunpoint for a couple grams of space rock? Modern meteorite collectors flirt with these situations routinely when searches occur in unstable parts of the world, which turn out to be a rather sizable portion of the planet when you look at it from the perspective of area. Much like playing frisbee with your friends is difficult without a frisbee, studying meteorites does not happen without meteorites. Of course, there is some fine and important work in the field that is done without samples, but most meteoriticists are very much dependent on actual samples of space rocks. Exactly how and which samples are obtained depends on the individual researcher. But from a community standpoint, we need samples, and the more the better. From the discipline's beginnings, if you knew the right people and were interested in the science of meteorites, it was at least possible to get your hands on some celestial material. That has not drastically changed in the last 200 plus years. Samples are generally available to anyone interested in studying them. But the procurement process of meteoritic material has changed a great deal from the days of just needing a buddy at the Natural History Museum. The search for more meteorites has prompted multi-million-dollar investments from several national governments looking to expand the community's access to rare samples. Modern meteorite collecting is not just a hobby for rock hounds with a desire for the exotic, but is a full-time and often very thrilling vocation for many. For most of human history, and the vast majority of time, meteorites have been a subject of study, meteorite collection has been not much more than a game of luck. If you were fortunate, you would stumble across a weird-looking rock that was a meteorite during a hike. Or maybe you would turn up something strange while plowing your field. This has happened a number of times. The discovery of the meteorite d'Orbigny, one of the oldest and arguably one of the most important basaltic meteorites, was made in 1979 when a farmer near Buenos Aires was plowing his cornfield and hit the 16.5-kilogram stone. Today, pieces of d'Orbigny sell for approximately $500 per gram. If you were really fortunate, you would see a meteorite fall and then go pick it up, or better yet, almost be hit by one, providing you with both a new souvenir and a fresh outlook on the fragility of life. But these types of witnessed falls, close encounters or not, are quite rare. To provide some context, let us revisit the first witnessed meteorite fall that we have a physical sample of, the Nogata meteorite that fell in Japan on May 19, 861. In the 1160 years since, there have been 1,206 confirmed falls as of early 2021, which, if you are good at math, works out to an average of just over one witnessed meteorite fall per year over the entire globe. Of course, this value is significantly front-loaded as the world's population has spread over time, causing more falls to be witnessed. These passive random encounters did a respectable job over the years of providing researchers, museums, and curio shops around the world with a reasonable stream of meteorites from a variety of types. Before 1955, there were just over 2,000 confirmed meteorites in the world's collections, with approximately 35% of those being witnessed falls. But in the mid-1950s, the world was changing fast and setting its sights on space. This collective upward gaze to the stars prompted a significant change in how meteorites were viewed. Demand for meteoritic material, both from the public and the scientific community, increased exponentially. While this interest surge had multiple catalysts, the most important was the NASA and the Soviet space programs starting to explore beyond Mother Earth. One corollary to these robust programs was that the equipment and methods, largely being designed to measure the imminent return of lunar samples, were similarly well-suited for addressing interesting questions meteorites had some of the answers to. In addition to the ramping up of space programs, another important event in the burgeoning world of meteoritics was the fortuitous falls of the Allende and Murchison meteorites in 1969, which, in perfectly coinciding with the space race, solidified meteorites as prized items to study and collect going forward. And when something turns out to have value to humans, society seems to find a way to obtain more of this sought-after item. Meteorites are certainly no exception. The hard truths of meteorite prospecting. One of the important basic facts about meteorites is that they fall all around the globe. Where they fall is unconnected to latitude, longitude, climatic zone, or political boundary. It is effectively just random, all around the world. As such, if someone is trying to find meteorites for either monetary or scientific purposes, they have to deal with this hard reality of randomness. Another ding is that more than 70% of Earth is covered by water, so an equal percentage of meteorites that fall are quickly rendered useless and lost forever. This, of course, narrows the areas of the Earth to search for meteorites to only the land parts, but some additional fine-tuning is still needed to make meteorite prospecting a worthwhile endeavor. Precious geologic commodities such as gold, diamonds, and oil are naturally concentrated in particular geologic environments. If one understands how those commodities are concentrated and where, one can elevate themselves to positions of mogul, magnate, or even tycoon. And since it does not take an economics wizard to know that it is more profitable to mine 1 ounce of gold from 1 ton of rock than it is to mine 1 ounce of gold from 10,000 tons of rock, finding areas of higher concentration of gold will get you looking and feeling tycoonish far faster. Areas of higher efficiency like this are precisely why economic geologists are trained to search for natural concentrations in the earth of certain things. And that is why some areas are exploited for raw materials and some areas are not. But meteorites are not your typical geologic commodity, and importantly, it's not necessarily the general lack of meteorites that is the biggest impediment to finding them. The bigger reason why our collections are not overflowing with samples from outer space is the general difficulty in locating and discerning meteorites camouflaged among regular terrestrial rocks. Complicated geochemical modeling, extensive seismic profiles, and thorough groundwater sampling are principal methods used to locate normal geologic treasures. But these are uniformly useless as aids in meteorite location. However, there are some notable and simple distinctions between meteorites and normal Earth rocks that can be helpful. Most meteorites are, 1, magnetic, and 2, dark in color. While these two generalizations ignore the properties of meteorites from larger bodies like Mars and the Moon, these unusual types of meteorites are extremely difficult to tell apart from common terrestrial rocks and, as such, require special circumstances and equipment to recognize. On the other side of the coin, obviously not everything that is magnetic and dark is a meteorite, but these characteristics work as a very effective first filter to protect against finding dreaded meteor wrongs. I would be remiss if this community joke was not made at least once in this book. Meteorites are more magnetic and are darker than most Earth rocks for a few very simple reasons. Firstly, meteorites in general have more iron than Earth rocks. Iron is magnetic, and since the bulk of Earth's iron is in its core, meteorites have more of it than most surface rocks on Earth, and are thus more magnetic. The reason most meteorites tend to be so dark is slightly more complicated. Not all meteoritic material is darker than Earth rocks. Some meteorites are actually very light in color. But meteorite surfaces are very often dark because of the perilous journey the meteorite experienced on the way to Earth. When meteoroids enter Earth's atmosphere, they are cruising along at incredible speeds. Earth's relatively thick atmosphere quickly slows down the intruder, causing some serious heat to build up around the rock, melting its outermost layer. Throughout its journey through the upper atmosphere, this process continues to ablate liquid rock off the meteoroid until the meteor slows down enough to stop melting itself, eventually landing on Earth's surface. The end result is a smaller rock than when it started into the atmosphere and a 1 to 2 millimeter dark scar-like crust on the meteorite known as a fusion crust, a great tool for determining what is a meteorite and what is not. Since there are at least a couple of simple, consistent characteristics that set meteorites apart from terrestrial rocks, it is possible to use these as aids in searching for extraterrestrial samples that happen to be lying around among earthly rocks. For instance, if you happen to be strolling around the desert and want to look for meteorites during your hike, just walk around with a magnet on a stick. You will likely see many dark rocks, so this magnet on a stick method is the easiest way to eliminate non-magnetic things that are probably not meteorites without bending over hundreds of times. In fact, this is such a famous method, you may even be familiar with the old meteorite prospector saying, "If your stick doesn't stick, you must not have quit looking." Whereas the magnetic method is probably the best choice when there are a lot of dark rocks around. There are vast areas of the planet that have a noticeable lack of dark objects, making the, "Hey, that is a dark rock" method a surprisingly useful meteorite location tool. In fact, the most productive meteorite hunting grounds on Earth are areas that, 1, naturally lack dark rocks, and 2, are devoid of vision-obscuring vegetation. This magic combination makes it far easier to locate meteorites that have fallen over the years. In case you are looking for an adventurous vacation that may help advance science in the process, here is a compiled list of the most important meteorite hunting grounds below. New Larbor Plains, Australia. One of the early recognized and particularly fruitful hunting grounds for meteorites is the New Larbor region of southern Australia. What the New Larbor lacks in trees, topography, and color, it makes up for in meteorite productivity. The flat, treeless expanse of the New Larbor is the largest single exposure of limestone in the world, so black rocks stick out quite dramatically. Also, because the New Larbor has an arid climate, and has for tens of thousands of years, meteorites do not degrade like they do in more temperate areas, meaning they tend to hang around waiting for intrepid hunters to spot them. For the true road trip fans, the New Larbor boasts one of the longest stretches of road in the world without any turns. Driving the Eyre Highway, you can motor along for more than 90 miles, 145 kilometers, without turning the wheel at all. While this may sound like an irresistible trip of a lifetime, it's important to keep in mind that Australian legislation designates all meteorites found in Australia as property of the Crown, and all fines must be turned over to authorities, meaning you will likely end up donating your newly located meteorite to one of Australia's fine public institutions. I know this sounds strange, since Australia does not have a king or a queen. So what crown are they talking about? I guess British colonialism dies a slower death in some places than in others. As a consequence of this law, meteorite hunting in Australia is only done by the truest of zealots, and the wide open spaces of the outback do not attract professional meteorite hunters. Even though Aussies may not have the most favorable laws for commercial meteorite collection, they, without question, have the best meteorite names in the game. As a rule, official meteorite names are taken from the name of a nearby town or location where the meteorite is found, And if you ever look at the list of meteorites from Australia, you will develop serious envy that folks down under get to occasionally give directions to places with names like Billy Goat Dunga, Cocklebiddy, or Laundry Rackhole. So, next time you are in Australia, I kindly ask you to send me a postcard from any one of these places, and I will proudly hang it on my refrigerator. The Atacama. The western coast of South America, particularly northern Chile, hosts the oldest and driest of all the hot deserts on Earth, the Atacama Desert. This desert has persisted in a hyper-arid state for at least 3 million years, with some areas mostly arid for the bulk of 200 million years. It's so dry, there are weather stations in the Atacama that have operated for generations that have never reported rain. Whereas this extended period of dry climate does not make the area ideal for growing rice or kumquats, it has preserved a bumper crop of meteorites. The Atacama may not have the advantage of a white limestone bedrock to highlight meteorites like the Nullarbor, but it has had a really long time for meteorites to accumulate, and since it so rarely rains, the meteorites that do land are preserved for shockingly long periods. Multiple meteorites found in the Atacama had lain there for more than 2 million years, an extremely long time for an exposed meteorite to survive on Earth. Measurements like these are called terrestrial residence ages and are determined by measuring the isotopic compositions of various gases trapped in the samples. These measurements allow scientists to determine how long a sample has been on Earth. Similar methods also make it possible to determine how long a meteorite was flying around space after it was dislodged from its parent body, but before it landed on Earth. And yes, you are right. It is awesome that we can figure stuff like that out. Because of its impressive aridity and long-term geologic stability, the Atacama is a very important meteorite reservoir and holds the tidal belt for the highest meteorite density of any of the hot deserts. As of early 2021, there were over 1,900 official meteorites from the slender country of Chile, virtually all of them from the Atacama. Oman. The Sultanate of Oman sits on the southeastern corner of the Arabian Peninsula. Based on this geography and its location on this list, you may have guessed it also boasts an arid climate well-suited for meteorite recovery. In addition to having exceptionally flat and dry areas, the Omani Desert has areas of intense white terrain. Carbonate beds and salt flats are common in Oman, providing a perfect backdrop to contrast dark meteorites. Private collectors and organized groups took notice of these favorable collection characteristics starting around 1999, and within 10 years, the Omani Desert had produced more than 5,000 meteorite fragments. Unlike Australia, meteorite collection is legal in Oman, and things can, by the letter of the law, be removed from the country and sold. Many of these fragments have since turned out to be paired stones, or pieces of the same parent meteorite found in different locations, which occurs when the meteorite breaks up as it travels through the atmosphere. Regardless, this is still an incredibly impressive haul. To date, approximately 4,000 distinct individual meteorites have been found in Oman. In addition, Oman has been lucky enough to be the landing zones of multiple lunar and Martian meteorites, adding to the scientific and monetary value of the collection zones. However, before you rush off to find your meteoritic fortunes on the salt plains of the Sultanate, or anywhere else, please consider the story of two of the world's best and most experienced meteorite hunters, Michael Farmer and Robert Ward. In 2011, the pair were 2 weeks into a collecting trip in Oman, Michael's 20th trip to the Sultanate. Having acquired exciting new finds and multiple new fragments of a lunar meteorite that Michael had found on a previous trip in 2005, all in all, it appeared to be quite a successful venture. Successful, that is, until they ended up in the bowels of an Omani prison on charges of illegal mining. Fortunately, the law was on Michael and Robert's side, and they were eventually released after appearing before a panel of judges. But that was only after they endured 3 hellish months, a prison riot, lost 40 pounds each, and gained a lifetime of nightmares. Lucky for us, Michael and Robert continued to search for and collect meteorites around the globe, but no longer in Oman. Later that same year, Michael was in Kenya on a collecting trip, and, well, I will let him tell it from his 2013 National Geographic article about his unique profession. I was down on my knees with a bag over my head and a machete on my throat and a gun at my head. Luckily, they just robbed him. In another interesting story, Michael smuggled himself into Algeria to look for meteorites and was chased by soldiers for hours through minefields before the Algerian junta chased him back to Morocco. The Mighty Sahara. From the previous examples, you likely predicted that the world's largest hot desert, the Sahara, and its approximately 3.5 million square miles, would be on a list of productive meteorite collection areas. You would not be wrong. Over the last 20 or so years, the Sahara has become one of the most important areas for meteorite collection and continues to produce more samples than can be cataloged and studied year after year, which, as a meteorite researcher, is a very good problem to have. The Sahara encompasses large parts of more than 10 gigantic countries, and whereas the political borders do not interrupt the virtually unbroken potential collection zone, the diversity of national laws and sporadic political unrest greatly complicate searches, collection, and export, particularly for non-local entities. As such, the vast majority of Saharan meteorites are collected by residents of the desert itself, not by jet-setting professional meteorite hunters or by academic consortiums. The exact origins of the meteorite boom in the Sahara are difficult to parse, but it seems that a lot of the credit goes to two specific occurrences from 1997. First, a French meteorite collector and dealer named Luc Leben was tooling around the Sahara in Mauritania with his family when he heard rumors of meteorites being found in neighboring Algeria, so he decided it was worth a look while he was nearby and in a similar region. Within just a few months, Leben had found more than 200 stones, unambiguously alerting scientists to the potential of the Sahara as a source of meteorites. Later that year, the American meteorite dealer Edwin Thompson established contact with a group of nomads through an English-speaking Moroccan middleman who had tracked and retrieved a sample from a fall in the El Hamami Mountains. Thompson flew to Mauritania in November 1997, and, thanks to help from the nomads and an exceptionally motivating wad of American cash, located over 200 kilograms of what is now officially known as the El Hamami meteorite. The scientific value of the meteorites that Leben and Thompson had acquired from Mauritania was minimal, but the potential, and more importantly, the market and procedure for meteorite collection was established, starting a gold rush of sorts in the Greater Sahara region. Word quickly spread, and ancient nomadic trade routes previously used for things like silk, salt, and gold were now being used to transport likely meteorites via camel caravan by the ton. As the nomads became increasingly adept at discerning meteoritic from terrestrial materials, and their profits grew, they roved deeper and deeper into the desert in search of rocks from space. Due to a combination of factors, including the nationality of the original meteoritic middleman, the desert outpost of Erfoud, Morocco, quickly became the center of the Saharan meteorite trade. For the billions of Brendan Fraser fans out there, Erfoud and the surrounding desert was where much of the terrible 1999 movie The Mummy was filmed. However, perhaps most important for this development is the lack of clarity regarding meteorites in Moroccan mining legislation. This legal void has allowed traders from all over North Africa to bring meteorites into Moroccan markets to be sold to international dealers, regardless of their actual country of origin. In just one particular example, many international museums refuse to even consider purchase of meteorites that were found in Algeria due to sticky legal issues of who actually owns the meteorite if it fell on Algerian soil. However, no such issues exist with meteorites found in Morocco. As a consequence, there is a shocking statistical overabundance of meteorites found in Morocco by nomads, and a correspondingly, and perhaps not so shocking, lack of meteorites found in countries with more problematic export policies. There have recently been calls from within Morocco to clarify laws on this subject, to ensure that at least some of the material recovered in Morocco stays in the country. This is a delicate issue, because while the idea of establishing museums in Morocco and holding on to meteoritic treasures from the country is a noble pursuit, the livelihoods of tens of thousands of people count on the meteorite trade in the country. Any change in policy could severely impact their lives, not to mention the flow of meteorites to the market and academic institutions for scientific study. Overall, it is difficult to wrap one's head around the number of meteorites that have come from the Sahara in the last few decades. Around 2,500 samples have known find locations in a variety of countries in the region, and another approximately 9,000 meteorites have been given the umbrella designation Northwest Africa, or NWA, because where the sample was collected is unknown or untold. In 1999, 45 NWA samples were classified. 20 years later, that number has grown by more than an order of magnitude, with barrels full of samples piling up just waiting to be classified. Ordinary chondrites, the most common type of meteorite finds and falls, are so abundant from desert collection that these types of meteorites are often ignored to save room for more interesting samples that will fetch higher prices. There are even tales of collectors piling up literal tons of ordinary chondrites in the desert to come back to at a later date if it was ever worth the bother. A Song of Rocks and Ice. The above-mentioned collection areas from hot desert regions have been incredibly important for a lot of reasons and have vastly increased the amount and type of meteoritic material available for study. However, from a sample volume perspective, there is no doubt which area is king. All hail Antarctica. The most basic ingredients required for meteorite collection are 1. A dry area for rocks to land, and 2. People to find said rocks. Antarctica has the first in abundance, but since the continent lacks a permanent population and has less than 5,000 people residing on it at any given time, you would be forgiven if you thought this would be a major problem for Antarctica in the race for meteorite collection supremacy. But Antarctica has a few tricks up its sleeves that hot deserts simply cannot compete with. The first meteorite discovered in Antarctica was in 1912, and a handful of others were recognized by various expeditions over the next 5 decades. However, the true potential for meteorite hunting in Antarctica was realized after a Japanese field excursion in December 1969. It's likely not a coincidence that this was recognized in 1969, the same year of Allende and Murchison meteorite falls, and humans landing on the moon. Space was on the brain at the time, and that helped the field of meteoritics an incredible amount. The excursion was charged with setting up survey stations in the East Antarctic ice sheet to facilitate the study of glacial movement in the area. In that single campaign, a campaign that was not even designed to be looking for meteorites, the group found 9 individual stones of a variety of types. This importantly meant that these rocks were not just a single stone that broke up in the atmosphere. They came from multiple meteorite falls from different parent bodies strewn across the glacial ice. When the circumstances of the finds were reported a few years later at the annual meeting of the Meteoritical Society, the late Bill Cassidy, a professor at the University of Pittsburgh at the time, grew very excited about the prospect of meteorites in Antarctica and almost immediately started formulating plans for collection trips to the icy expanse. Cassidy was not deterred by his perhaps predictable multiple rejections for funding from the National Science Foundation. Sadly, the reviews were not pretty and are said to have included the term ludicrous and had the general tone of wondering why we would even bother collecting meteorites in the first place. Keeping the idea alive through collaboration with colleagues from Japan, it was decided that the same glaciology group that had reported the finds in 1969 would also search for meteorites during their 1975-76 season. With this additional task of actively looking for samples when they could, that same patch of ice at the base of the Yamato Mountains yielded 663 more specimens. Not surprisingly, Cassidy was approved shortly thereafter to lead a team of two American scientists out of McMurdo Station to search for meteorites the next season in Antarctica. It is funny what a little international competition can do to loosen up the purse strings. Since the first 1976-77 dedicated field season, the United States, as well as other nations, has sent teams every year to collect meteorites from the glaciers of Antarctica. The U.S.-led team, called ANSMET, for the Antarctic Search for Meteorites, generally takes between 6 to 12 volunteers to camp and search along the slopes of the Trans-Antarctic Mountains. This is a highly competitive process, and being selected for a trip is considered a huge honor by the meteorite community. Because the team needs experienced people to deal with the dangers and difficulties of living in Antarctica, only a couple new people were allowed to go every year. This also means if you have been once, you have a decent chance at being selected again. Each season lasts around 6 to 7 weeks, with the weather largely dictating how much time is spent in a 9-square-foot tent, potentially wishing for a better companion for such tight quarters. But when the weather cooperates, volunteers get to search the blue ice fields or glacial moraines on a snowmobile for primitive pieces of the solar system for the betterment of science. Even more than the barrels upon barrels of extraterrestrial material recovered from the ice by these intrepid search parties, according to every ANSMET participant I've spoken to, the most memorable thing the group takes home after the field season are the fierce bonds of friendship born from battling and conquering the extreme environment of the Antarctic with their cohorts. The amount of material that has been collected on trips to Antarctica over the last approximately 45 years is almost unfathomable. Collectively, teams from across the globe have found more extraterrestrial material in Antarctica than has been collected over recorded time, everywhere else combined. The primary players are the United States and Japan. However, China and various European contingents have also organized collection trips. To date, well over 45,000 officially classified meteorites have been found in Antarctica. But this insane number of meteorites was not collected by expeditions just looking around the ice randomly. Collection areas are chosen for a variety of reasons, but one of the most important is to look in areas where the downward flow of a glacier meets the base of a mountain. As it turns out, the glaciers of Antarctica are providing an incredible service to the meteorite community, acting as a giant but slow conveyor belt of meteorites. Like anywhere on Earth, meteorites can and do land on top of glaciers. Since glaciers are giant rivers of ice slowly creeping downhill, any meteorite that lands on a glacier catches a free ride on the flowing ice. If a glacier runs into a mountain, the ice and all of its passengers pile up at its base. As this happens, dry Antarctic winds ablate the ice as it piles up, exposing the meteorites. When this process is continued over great spans of time, this results in far higher concentrations of meteorites at the base of the mountain than would be on any random stretch of ice, making the bases of the Trans-Antarctic Mountains an absolute wonderland for meteorite collection. From meteorite collection to sample distribution. While the meteorites collected during Antarctic expeditions are curated by NASA at the Johnson Space Center and are available for scientific study by request, most meteorites collected outside of Antarctica eventually are dumped into the free market at some point. Some of the less reputable dealers will immediately place stones up for sale as soon as they are found, either in a janky roadside rock and mineral shop or on the internet. This can be a way to buy actual meteorites, but it can also be a way for the uninitiated to greatly overpay for a piece of concrete, iron slag, or petrified dog turd. On the other hand, reputable meteorite hunters and dealers routinely partner with academic institutions to officially classify new meteorites, meaning that once the stone is classified by an expert and some basic chemical and mineralogical measurements are taken, the stone and its designation are entered into the Meteoritical Bulletin Database, maintained by the Meteoritical Society. There are significant benefits to all parties with this arrangement. The dealer gets expert classification information to provide to potential buyers, and the classifying parties keep a portion of the sample in that institution's collection for later study, as well as obtain information from the finder or dealer about where and how it was acquired, information that is generally lost if the meteorite is sold out of a wheelbarrow on the side of the road. One of the genuinely nice things about meteorites is that they are basically impossible to fake. With a little bit of training, most people can distinguish between meteorites and terrestrial rocks in most cases. Counterfeiting rocks of really any type is not a reasonable path to fortune, and the textures and minerals present in many meteorites are essentially impossible to recreate on Earth, even with incredibly sophisticated equipment. It can sometimes be difficult to tell if something is definitively a meteorite, but it is usually very easy to tell when something is not a meteorite. The Tucson Gem and Mineral Show. Regardless of how, where, or if a meteorite was classified, the goal of most dealers and hunters is to sell or trade the sample for something of value to them. You know, capitalism. Of course, these sales and trades happen at a variety of venues, large and small, on the internet and in person, but by far, the most important place where meteorite deals are made is at the annual Tucson Gem and Mineral Show in Tucson, Arizona. Speaking from experience, the event is absolutely surreal, whether or not you are into rocks. The event is so large, it is not simply held at a convention center, but is spread out across the city of Tucson. Meteorite dealers in particular seem to try to avoid the main convention hall, where enormous mineral displays and spectacular fossils are the prime attractions. Instead, the space rock folks gravitate to hotels like the Days Inn, the Ramada, the Howard Johnson. And I don't mean hotel lobbies or banquet halls. I mean the individual rooms. Many dealers routinely rent a room for the week and spread their merchandise across the floral patterns atop king-size beds. Potential buyers walk from room to room, awkwardly navigating narrow passages, searching for deals. It sounds shady as hell, but it would not be weird at this show for someone to spend $150,000 in the kitchenette of a Days Inn to legitimately purchase a piece of Mars. Consequences of the meteorite trade. The windfall of meteorites provided over the last few decades from the multitude of collection areas on Earth has been a game changer for meteorite studies. The exponentially higher number of samples has not only furnished a lot more material to study, but has also helped researchers recognize new groups of meteorites, better understand the flux of meteorites to Earth, and even investigate them as potential paleoclimate markers tracking desert conditions over geologic time as meteorites degrade. whereas it would be difficult to argue that the scientific consequences have been anything but positive, it's important to at least consider the potential negatives for society that have developed, or could develop, through meteorite collection. Such concern, after all, has not always been exercised during the extraction of more traditional geologic resources, such as diamonds or oil. The first and probably most challenging concern to deal with is the case of meteorites now part of private or institutional collections that were, or are, treated as sacred artifacts by indigenous peoples. There are a few examples of this, perhaps the most famous being the Willamette meteorite, which was found in 1902 in the Willamette River Valley of Oregon, where it has long been sacred to members of the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde Community of Oregon. As you might have guessed, shortly after its existence was discovered by a non-indigenous local resident, the meteorite was transported to the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, where it remains on permanent display. There is currently an agreement between the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde Community and the American Museum of Natural History, and a small piece of the meteorite has been returned as a symbolic gesture. As these cases are rare, they tend to be, and probably should be, dealt with on an individual basis. However, issues surrounding modern meteorite collection are a different bucket of worms entirely. Depending on the situation, the effect of modern meteorite collecting can range from being felt by just a handful of people to altering the economics of entire countries. There are two main ways of finding previously unknown meteorites. The first and most exciting scenario is when a fireball occurs where fresh meteoritic material lands on the ground. It is then important to gather the material as quickly as possible. The longer the sample sits around on Earth, the less pristine it is when studied. From a scientific perspective, gathering material before the sample is rained on is incredibly advantageous. From an economic one, the sample is also worth more on the open market when the reports are fresh in people's minds. This urgency then means when a fall occurs, a handful of outsiders rush to the scene in country X and scour the area for something that they can make a lot of money from. At first glance, this may carry echoes of colonialism, but meteorite hunters are certainly not there to steal the rocks and subjugate the landowners. They happily pay the landowners for the stones they find based on negotiation. They will pay less than what they make in the meteorite market, but it is a business. And businesses like this make money by buying something at a lower price than they sell it for. The hunter would make the reasonable argument that if the rock were not located and identified, it would be worth nothing to the landowner, and they are paying them a nice sum of money for something that happened to randomly land on their property just a few days prior. On the other hand, others might argue that the hunter is taking advantage of the less meteorite savvy, making a significant profit from something that should instead result in a hefty payday or family heirloom for the lucky landowner. Both sides have points, but this arrangement generally seems to work out for all parties. The landowner gets paid a sum of money for nothing more than a stroke of cosmic luck. The meteorite hunters obtain new samples to put on the market, and science benefits due to the quick actions and rapid recovery. The other meteorite collecting scenario is far less urgent and occurs when there was no witnessed fall, but it affects a far greater number of people. In practice, this largely involves meteorite hunters hiking around dry lake beds, salt flats, or otherwise barren landscapes, searching for pieces of the early solar system in various places around the world. How this is dealt with completely depends on the country, as discussed in previous examples. In the Australian example, thousands of meteorites may end up wasting away in the outback because there is no monetary incentive to go look for them. As such, non-academic hunters in general will not spend time searching for things they know will largely be confiscated by the mysterious crown anyway, and science loses out on a lot of potential samples because of it. A recent example of changing laws takes us to the Campo del Cielo meteorite and strewn field of Argentina. More than 100 tons of Campo del Cielo iron meteorite material has been recovered to date, making it one of the most commonly available iron meteorites in the world. To summarize a complicated story spanning multiple decades, following the finding, unearthing, abandonment, and attempted later removal of a specimen dubbed El Chaco, a series of provincial Argentinian laws were passed in 1994 to keep pieces of the meteorite in their original locations. It is worth noting, however, that those original locations are almost entirely underground, meaning that the likely very significant portion of the remaining material from this meteorite will just rust underground without anyone ever even knowing about it. Authorities have reportedly even sealed into drums and reburied confiscated pieces of the meteorite. While it can easily be argued that legislation written to protect, properly conserve, study, and display natural history specimens, such as meteorites, benefits society as a whole, nobody benefits from this particular situation. Not the locals, not the government, not the environment, not the scientists, and certainly not meteorite hunters or the meteorites themselves. The opposite extreme is a place like Morocco, where tons upon tons of meteorites legally leave the country every month, and very few, if any, stay in the hands of Moroccan museums or researchers. On its face, that also seems like a bad situation, particularly for Morocco. However, there are a limited number of meteorite researchers in Morocco, and few museums equipped to curate any significant number of meteorites. Until the infrastructure and capabilities are better supported in Morocco, keeping significant material in-country would not necessarily be good for Morocco, and it would certainly not be scientifically prudent, as potentially exciting samples would languish unstudied. Given humanity's history of natural resource exploitation in developing nations, it is understandable to think of the exploding business of meteorite collection in this context. And it is easy to present a few individual examples as imperfect situations in the worldwide meteorite market. However, it is also reasonably easy to argue that the status quo for meteorite recovery is overall pretty fair and robust. The system in place works surprisingly well for most people involved, from landowner to hunter to scientist. Additionally, there is very little environmental impact associated with meteorite removal. To say there are no issues is folly, but the general system has developed in a way that seems to maximize scientific output and minimize the negative impacts, which is a good balance to shoot for. Regardless of the discussion about the morality and business of meteorites, meteorite monetization has been both a blessing and a curse for meteorite researchers. On the good side of things, it has produced a market in which people go searching for meteorites, thinking a large payday might await them if they find the right kind of stone. On the bad side of things, the open market can be a difficult place to compete for samples if your research group is working on a tight budget. Scholarly-leaning hunters and collectors, museums, and the Antarctic meteorite collections are what keep research affordable and possible. Overall, the greatly increased availability of samples in the recent decades has been a huge boon for understanding our origins and the early solar system. However, questions from the public regarding the financial worth of meteoritic samples are constant reminders that meteoriticists must continue to discuss the importance of what we learn from the samples and stress that these rocks are not just another fungible commodity. They are unique time capsules of information from the deep past that contain information we have no other way of obtaining.